listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Leonid.
Hello, Bob. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for making the time. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well.
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Leonid Rogozin, a journalist based in Latvia, although you're from Russia originally. You've written for a number of places, BBC, The Guardian, lately for Al Jazeera. In fact, you've written a piece just within the last few days about this Tucker Carlson interview of Vladimir Putin. I definitely want to talk about that because your take is a little different from some of the takes we saw in the West. I'm really looking forward to this conversation because I have, frankly, been kind of distracted by the Middle East and haven't been paying as much attention to the Ukraine-Russia situation as I had been before October 7th. And so I'm hoping you can kind of catch me up on the state of play there. Why don't we start out, though, with this interview, this Tucker Carlson interview of Putin. First of all, how would you say the interview was kind of processed in the West to the extent that you could tell? I mean, I assume, you know, I know you're on Twitter and people should follow you, by the way. Your feed is, it's just your name, right?
That's right. Leonid
Rogozin. L-E-O-N-I-D.
As is one word.
Right. R-A-G-O-Z-I-N. And then I'm sure you check out the main outlets, the New York Times and so on. How would you say that interview was kind of processed in the West, if that's not asking for too much of a generalization?
No, I think it's fair to say that all the commentary was focusing on the first half an hour of the interview when Putin said that he is going to talk about history for a mere 30 seconds, and then he bragged on about it about extinct empires and medieval princes for a good half an hour. So there was a lot of ridicule, and that ridicule was quite fair. And apart from that, there were some shocking statements, including the suggestion that Poland precipitated the World War II by not agreeing to Hitler's demands in 1939. Mm-hmm. So that's where the commentary was focused, really. And there was a lot of mocking. People were ridiculing Putin, but I wouldn't say that is unfortunate. It's of Putin's own making. However, the bigger part of the interview, where he was actually talking about Ukraine, about modern Ukraine, and about recent history, that was omitted. But in my opinion, that part of the interview is where Putin is trying to explain his own logic, which is often missed in the discourse in the West. And that logic is of him being, in his opinion, constantly duped by the West, and his entire career from the early 2000s, when he was trying to be as helpful as possible to President Bush in the aftermath of 9/11. He was the first leader to give a phone call to Bush Jr. He offered Russian a transportation system and almost created a military base for the Americans on the Russian territory, a logistics base on the Russian territory. But he pretty sincerely hoped that Russia was on the path towards integration with Euro-Atlantic structures. However, what he got in exchange is a type of NATO's expansion, which essentially excluded Russia, which alienated Russia, And that's the cause of his grievances. So he was talking at length about Bucharest summit and then all the events that followed.
So the Bucharest summit, remind us, is that the one where they decided they declared that Ukraine would eventually be a member of NATO?
Well, that's where Ukraine and Georgia received official invitation to become NATO countries. So there was the start of a very long process. And at the time, France and Germany were strongly against it, whereas Bush was intent on getting Georgia and Ukraine on board. I guess the philosophy, the thinking behind it in the United States was that Russia was irrelevant. It didn't matter what the Russians say and that they feel insulted about it. They will take the bitter pill and maybe eventually come on board as well. Mm-hmm. But the result was quite the opposite. It antagonized Russia and started a chain of events that I believe led up to this conflict.
That was Putin's argument during the interview, in effect.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was the first in the list of his grievances that he mm-hmm. That he put on the table, and then he proceeded from there into Maidan Revolution and then into the war with Ukraine.
That's 2014. Let me interrupt you because I didn't see the interview, but the way it was kind of depicted, it seems to me, on social media in the West was almost as the opposite of what you've just said. In other words, people focused on the first half hour where he's going on and on about Russian heritage. And I guess at some point he must have talked about how Ukraine is naturally a part of Russia, or parts of Ukraine are naturally part of Russia, or whatever. I mean, first of all, did he get into that at some point?
Yes, he did. He channeled the Russian nationalist myth. What he was basically saying is that the Russians and Ukrainians come from the same root, right. That they have common history. And then he dwelt for a long time on the composition of Ukraine, on how Ukraine came to be in the current borders, which largely happened in the Soviet times. From the general Russian nationalist point of view, when they start looking at different parts of Ukraine, they will say that only the historical core of Ukraine around Kyiv is the actual core Ukraine that derives from the Kievan Rus, whereas all the southeast was colonized by Russians and Ukrainians together during the Russian mm-hmm. imperial times when the Russian Empire was expanding. Ukraine expanded even further in the Soviet times, and especially after the Second World War, when the Soviet Union annexed what is now Western Ukraine, which was mm-hmm. Partly Poland, partly Hungary, and partly Romania.
So I guess, the spin in the West was, okay, so this just confirms our claim that the reason he invaded is because he has imperial aspirations. Who knows where he'll stop? Poland may be next. And so far as I can tell, people pretty much, at least mainstream kind of commentators, pretty much entirely ignored the part you talked about earlier about how NATO, if you want to ask, it sounds like Putin was saying, if you want to know why we feel entitled to keep our troops in Southeast and Eastern Ukraine, it's because it's as you know, in some sense, a natural part of Russia. But it sounds like in explaining why he actually invaded in the first place, he was stressing these national security issues, beginning with NATO, and then saying that the West mishandled the 2014 Maidan revolution, and so on. And that part I did not hear in the kind of Western spin on this. I mean, was that your impression, that there wasn't a lot of attention paid to what he said about NATO expansion and how the West has repeatedly, humiliated Russia or not delivered on its promises or whatever?
Yeah, I think it's the question of whether you, on how you interpret what Putin says. And if your starting point is that he always lies, then of course you can you may consider everything he says as a lie, as a way of framing his actions, which were monstrous, in fact, framing them in retrospect. That's not necessarily what was happening.
Yeah.
I think the main message Putin was trying to convey, and he stressed that in when he was describing each of these crucial turning points in history, whether Bucharest summit or Maidan revolution or Istanbul talks at the start of the full-out invasion. Mm-hmm. His message always was that Ukraine and the West always had a choice of avoiding this conflict at each of this point. At each of these points, as an example, for when he was talking about the occupation of Crimea and the end of Maidan revolution, he dwelt for a long time on the agreement that was achieved between the government of Viktor Yanukovych and the Maidan opposition. And that agreement was mediated by Germany, France, and Poland. What he said is that had the opposition not ignored the agreement, had they not started to take over government buildings and forced Yanukovych to flee, Russia wouldn't have invaded Crimea. That's his position. And again, he conveyed this feeling of being duped by the West. He said that once the opposition took over the government buildings, once Yanukovych fled, the Western mediators threw the agreement into the furnace. And that, from his perspective, from his current perspective, mm-hmm. prompted him to invade Crimea. Whether that's true or not, that's a matter of argument, because it was clear that the Russians were preparing something in Crimea even before that happened. They were active in Crimea. But it's also true that they were changing their stance on Crimea, even when it comes to the referendum, the so-called referendum they held in the March of 2014. At first, the question in the referendum was about Crimea's autonomy, and only later, as the events unfolded, did they change it to Crimea becoming a part of Russia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, So this theme in your Al Jazeera piece about how a couple of things, I mean, he sees himself as being repeatedly reactive to the West. If you look at the chain of events that led to the invasion, you say he sees himself as repeatedly reacting to things, in particular, his being misled or duped or the Russia or the West not delivering on promises. You know, I don't know if you have you seen this interview he did at some point with the director Oliver Stone.
I know what you're talking about, but I didn't watch
this moment.
Too.
There's this moment at the end, Oliver Stone gives him some like DVD or CD or something as like, I guess, kind of a gift. I didn't even know what's in it. But Putin says, thank you. And the interview is over. Putin says thank you, and he walks out of the room, closes the door, and then he comes right back in, and he opens the case, and see, they had forgotten to put the DVD in the case. So they'd given him an empty case, and what Putin says is typical Western gift. You know, and that is obvious. That is his actual view, right? Like the West, you know, and I mean, honestly, if you look at the early part of you know, after 9/11, he does feel he went out of his way. He was the first one to call Bush, but Bush did all of these things that he didn't want Bush to do, such as get out of the ABM treaty and so on. I mean, that is definitely his narrative. Is your sense that he believes it? I mean, he feels genuinely kind of consistently betrayed, or?
No, I think, yes. I think he quite sincerely believed that he was being treated by the West in a colonial way, as a non-equal. And it showed at the time in various ways. My favorite example is this cover in the Atlantic magazine, which had Russia's finished, you know, across the cover. That cover was published, that magazine was published in 2001, that's the second year of Putin's rule. So, I mean, now we can be sure how wrong it was.
Yeah.
Back at the time, so but that was the sentiment that he was facing, and he felt that the way the Western establishment is talking to him, and particularly the way the Americans were talking to him, is like sort of will pay the lip service to Russia's greatness, to Russia's own perceived greatness, and will do all the respectful stuff, but in reality will just ignore anything Russia says, particularly on its own security and on security in Europe.
Okay, so I mean, maybe I may want to get back to this issue of how he sees the past and what the past in fact is, but the other big takeaway. In fact, this is the headline of your piece in Al Jazeera, is Putin is ready for talks on Ukraine, but on his own terms. His interview with Tucker Carlson reveals how he envisions negotiations and peace. So I want to talk about that. I also, but first let me editorialize a little bit about the Western media. So New York Times, it has that in its kind of headline, Putin calls on U.S. to negotiate on Ukraine in Tucker Carlson interview. But then when you read the piece, it's just interesting the way they lead into it. Now, this is written by this guy, Anton Troyanovsky. You're familiar with him, right?
Yeah, absolutely. He's a very good journalist.
Yeah, okay. I actually don't share that view. But let me just, it seems to me he has, let me just read his piece. President Vladimir Putin of Russia has worked for decades to win allies in the West, using his spy agencies to interfere in elections and deploying diplomats to build links with Kremlin-friendly politicians. On Thursday, the world witnessed a new verbose chapter in those efforts. Mr. Putin's two-hour interview, taped in a gilded hall at the Kremlin with one of America's most prominent and most divisive, blah, blah, blah. The next, he goes on and it's like, okay, you can lead with election interference if you want. I mean, I don't think it's really the heart of the story. And the New York Times had a separate piece that was kind of about the atmospherics of the interview and so on. So they had their chance to kind of editorialize it. I mean, they had a separate reportorial piece. This guy's job was to deliver the news. And as the headline suggests, he eventually gets to it. But I have found his coverage personally consistently kind of like this. And I could go on, but I respect your view that he's a good journalist. I'm sure in some respects he is. But so anyway, you got to the, I don't know, did you want to say something about what I just said or?
Yeah, I might just say that, look, why the reason Putin gave this interview to Tucker Carlson, and he wouldn't do any interviews with Western journalists after the start of the full-out invasion. The only reason was that the aid to Ukraine is a major issue in the Congress. Republicans aligned with Donald Trump are trying to prevent Biden's administration right. to send this crucial aid to Ukraine. So the whole thing was very, very obviously to derail aid to Ukraine and, of course, to embarrass Biden's administration. You can't take those words out of the song. It's true. And New York Times, writing for the American audience, of course, it is quite American-centric. So it's all about America. Yeah. It's all about American politics. From the point of view of American domestic politics, that's what this interview was about. I'm here in Eastern Europe, and it's a very different perspective, and there's a lot more to talk about this interview than yeah. Its implication on Biden's prospects to right. get reelected.
No, I think that's all true. But as I said, the Times had other coverage kind of on the of that. Anyway, my issues with this particular journalist go way back, and I could elaborate, but I won't. Let's talk about this part of it. Like, what's your takeaway on? I mean, first of all, we should maybe set the context by saying, in case there's anybody who, like me, has been a little distracted by the Middle East, that over the last 3 months, you know, things definitely have not gotten better for Ukraine on the battlefield. As we speak, Ukraine seems to be in the process of losing, what is it, Avdiivka? I don't know how you pronounce it, Avdiivka. It's a pretty important town, I guess.
Avdiivka.
It's probably the most important town to change hands, I don't know, maybe since Bakhmut, right? I mean, it's something they've been fighting over a long time. And as we speak, I don't think Ukraine is quite withdrawn, but it looks as if they're going to have to, right?
No, they haven't withdrawn yet, but yes, it's a likelihood, and one of the most respectful Ukrainian war monitoring services, is called the Deep State, incidentally. It essentially called on the Ukrainian command to withdraw from Avdiivka. And also uh-huh. one of the Ukrainian military spokesmen said today that in Avdiivka, the priority for Ukraine is saving soldiers' lives and not, as he said, fighting for the heaps of stones and burnt iron. So that might suggest that they are thinking of withdrawing there. At the same time, they did send in reserves, the 3rd Assault Brigade. So it's not quite clear whether they're going to keep on fighting for some time. But yeah, it was the main battle since Bakhmut, since another battle last year. And it's looking very likely that within days or maybe weeks, the Russians will prevail on this battlefield.
And of course, there are doubts as to whether they're going to get another round of American support. I'm kind of guessing they will right now. And maybe by the time we post this, things will have become clearer. But at the same time, it's kind of clear that Ukraine can't necessarily count on Western help forever. And of course, they're dependent on the West for weapons and ammo in a way that Russia is not as dependent on anyone. And then there's the whole manpower issue. You know, Ukraine seems to be, you know, maybe not quite running out of soldiers, but they're a lot closer than Russia is. So in general, and of course, there was the failure of the summer offensive. And so in general, the momentum seems to be with Russia as we speak, right? That's your sense. And presumably that is the sense that Putin carried into this interview, right?
No, absolutely. I think he's feeling pretty confident that he is having an upper hand in Ukraine. There is a consensus across the board that Ukraine is not going to wage any counteroffensive during 2024. That at best it can hold off the Russian advance and not lose a lot of territory, and there is hope with the more hawkish community, reflected maybe in the latest British report by the main military think tank in Britain, that by 2025-2026 Ukraine will somehow manage to grow its strength, to grow its military production, and strengthen its army, whereas Russia will be worn off and its economy will start collapsing. So that's the hope, which I'm sure Putin is not sharing. And I don't think most of Russian economists are sharing at the moment. Yeah. Yes, there is also a consensus among the hawks that Ukraine should keep fighting. And it derives from the fact that if Ukraine agrees to some kind of truce or frozen conflict now, it will be essentially a defeat for Ukraine and the West. And that's because the benchmark is still Minsk Agreement. Minsk Agreement, which Ukraine essentially dismissed on the eve of the full-out invasion. One of the main spokesmen for the Ukrainian government, Alexei Arestovych, back at the time in March 2022, he put it quite clearly. That anything worse than Minsk will be Ukraine's defeat. And I think he expressed the point of view of the entire Ukrainian government. So what Ukraine is going to get now is definitely going to be worse than Minsk. Yeah. Minsk presumed that the territory that was occupied by Russia back in 2014, 2015, wouldn't even be annexed by Russia. It would remain in Ukraine as a kind of a Trojan horse that would prevent Ukraine from ever entering NATO, that would leave Russia with a leverage in Ukraine. But on the other hand, these areas would remain inside Ukraine. So now we are talking about four regions.
Let me just make sure I understand that part. So the Minsk Accords, this is after 2014, after the Maidan thing, right? And the Minsk Accords would have kept all of the Donbass in Ukrainian hands, but I guess not Crimea, right? They wouldn't have. Well, you tell me. I mean, because this was after Russia had occupied Crimea, right?
No, absolutely. Russia occupied Crimea, and Russia formally annexed Crimea. Russia right. formally declared Crimea its territory. So Crimea was not a subject of negotiations in Minsk, which were mediated by France and Germany. The idea behind Minsk is that Donbass, the areas of Donbass, and this is where parts of Donetsk and Luhansk regions, not even those regions entirely, that these territories will become an autonomy within Ukraine, and that elections would be held and that Russian troops would eventually withdraw from those areas. So that's the template for this is, I guess, Transnistria in Moldova, which is a part of Moldova that is autonomous, but still considered by everybody, including Russia, as a part of Moldova.
And tell me if I'm right in recalling something you said last time we talked, which was a few months ago. So So Minsk would, as you say, would have kept Donetsk and Luhansk within Ukraine, giving it a degree of autonomy. I think an important part is it would have given them an effective kind of veto over major foreign policy changes, which would have meant, in effect, the Ukraine would not have entered NATO. But they would have been part of Ukraine. The separatist held parts would have come under full Ukrainian control. And I think you explained to me last time, and the context for my question that you were answering then was the fact that in December of 2022, or maybe November, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, U.S., Mark Milley, had said, look, this was after a couple of big triumphs on the battleground by Ukraine. And Milley said, look, things probably aren't going to get much better. This would be a good time to cut a deal. I wrote a piece a few weeks later in the Washington Post saying, you know, Biden should use his leverage. He should basically play the bad cop to take the political pressure off Zelensky. He should let Zelensky blame him for the fact that Zelensky is going to go to peace talks with Russia and basically do what Mark Milley said. Now, of course, at that point, I mean, in retrospect, it seems like they would have been better off because, as I said, momentum seems to be shifting. A ton of Ukrainians have died since then. They probably would have been better off doing the deal then, but that would have left Russia in control of parts of actual Ukraine beyond Crimea. And you explained to me, when I ask you, like, why doesn't Zelensky start preparing public opinion for the inevitability of some deal like this by, you know, start saying, well, we may have to settle for less than we'd like and so on. You explained to me, like, because then he will be blamed for not following through on the Minsk Accords. Is that right? Like, maybe I'm misremembering, but as I recall, you were saying this will be a worse deal than Zelensky probably could have had at some point before the invasion, if I'm recalling correctly, to say nothing of the deal that, according to Putin and some other people, was offered right after the invasion, which would have led to Russian withdrawal from everything but Crimea. Tell me if I'm misremembering. What was it you explained to me about Ukrainian politics?
No, that's very much. Thank you for bringing it up. Milley's comments, because yes, there was this moment, and Milley was very right that it was the best moment for Ukraine to negotiate a better peace with Russia. And yes, you're also right in saying that that peace would have been worse than what Ukraine had before Russia's full-out invasion. So that of course was why Zelensky eventually decided not to go for it. And I guess that was also the consensus in Biden's administration, notwithstanding Milley's private opinion on that. They started preparing for the counteroffensive in 2023, and they hoped that they will achieve a lot. They will have a much better situation by the end of this counteroffensive, if not pushing the Russians all the way to the 1991 borders, says Zelensky, hope maybe pushing them back, so it at least it is as bad as it was at the start of the invasion, as bad as when Ukraine had the Minsk option. So we now know that it didn't happen. That Ukraine is now worse off than it was at the time. And Russia is now advancing, and the more time goes, as it stands now, the more territory Russia will occupy, and claim as Russian, essentially. So Putin's message in the interview, and it was followed up by several of his lieutenants, so to say, later by his press secretary and by one of the foreign ministry officials. It basically says that we are ready to get back to the framework of Istanbul talks, the talks that happened in the weeks after the start of the full-out invasion. But all the territory that we have occupied so far is going to stay in Russia.
So whereas at Istanbul, am I right in thinking the idea was that Russia would actually have withdrawn from everything but Crimea in exchange for guarantees that Ukraine would not join NATO and so on? That was the deal on the table a few weeks into the invasion?
Well, as I understand it, the deal on the table, according to Ukrainian and Western sources, was that Russia would withdraw to the line of contact prior to the full-out invasion.
Okay.
So the Russian troops would stay in the parts of Donetsk and Luhansk region that were occupied in 2014-2015. But that would have been a major win for Ukraine, because back at the time, Russian troops were near Kiev. They were in the suburbs of Kiev, and Russia occupied swathes of northern Ukraine, and it was besieging Mariupol in the southern Ukraine, and it was building the land corridor to Crimea.
That would have left Russia with way less territory than they have now.
Absolutely.
And I gather that Putin, in his interview with Carlson, is emphasizing they're going to hang on to, if there's a peace, and he's apparently saying he's ready to talk peace, but they're going to hang on to all the territory they've got. Is that what he's saying?
No, absolutely. I guess to conceptualize Putin's attitude to peace, and you might help me if there is an English equivalent to a Russian expression pertaining to turf wars between mafias. So the idea is there is a Russian expression which is postavit na счётчик. Literally, it means to put someone on a counter. On a counter,
like their time is running out.
Well, the idea is that the punishment grows exponentially with each time unit of intransigence.
Okay.
So you can picture a racketeer in gang which attacks a business and says that today you pay me $100, but tomorrow you'll pay $200, and day after tomorrow you'll pay $1,000. So that's what Putin is doing with Ukraine. And thinking of Putin's years in the 1990s in St. Petersburg, when he was dealing with mafias and many people's point of view was part of this mafia. That's very much part of the culture, and this expression is one of the key expressions that remains as the legacy of those days in the contemporary Russian language.
So by that, does he mean that if you don't seize this opportunity for peace, we're going to take more territory? Or is he saying if you don't seize this opportunity, we're going to demand more in other realms, or what? Do you know what he means by this exactly?
Yeah, that's why he was he went into all this talk about history, about recent history. What he's basically saying is that we were not planning to seize Crimea, but what happened at the end of Maidan, those agreements being thrown into the furnace, as he said, that kind of prompted us to invade Crimea. And then there were Minsk agreements, and the the lack of desire by Ukraine and its Western partners, which is now in the obvious. Everybody said that they were not going to comply with Minsk agreements. The lack of that desire prompted him to prepare and start the full-out invasion.
Can I just clarify? Are you saying it is now clear? Because there's dispute over whose fault it is that the Minsk agreements failed. Are you saying it is now clear that Ukraine, more than Russia, failed to deliver on the Minsk Accords, failed to stick with the commitments?
Well, there is still an argument, and the hawkish community will, of course, say that it was Russia that was not going to implement Minsk agreements. But at the same time, several major politicians, leaders, in fact, including Zelensky himself, basically said that they were never going to implement Minsk agreements. Okay. Those were Zelensky himself in a Spiegel interview. It was President Poroshenko, the predecessor of Zelensky. It was Angela Merkel, and it was Hollande, the former president of France.
Okay.
Everybody in different forms suggested that Minsk was never, because it was imposed on Ukraine, that's also true. It was imposed on Ukraine by force. So all the parties who which participated in the signing of these agreements, they believed, apart from Russia, of course, they believed that things will change and hopefully Russia will somehow soften its stance on these agreements.
So sorry,
When I was talking to American experts, in the round up to the full out invasion, they spoke a lot about what they called the better Minsk, getting the better Minsk. And better Minsk is basically improving the conditions for Ukraine, and maybe Ukraine getting more control over these territories, or maybe these territories not having a veto on Ukraine's NATO membership. I'm not quite sure what they meant by this, but that seemed to be the policy of Jake Sullivan and Biden's administration in the run up to the full out invasion.
Okay. So sorry, I interrupted you when I asked for background on Minsk. Now, where were you? Do you remember where you were headed?
No, I don't at the moment, but
sorry.
I think we've pretty much covered it.
Okay. So Putin is ready to talk, but he's saying, which I've kind of thought he was for a long time now, but I've also thought that he would insist on keeping the territory he's got. You know, it would be pretty hard to go back to the Russian people and say, sorry about the 100,000 dead soldiers. We didn't get anything at all for it in terms of territory, right? I mean, I'm sure he, for a lot of reasons, there are other reasons. He's actually lost a lot. Like, Finland is now part of NATO. Sweden's going to be part of NATO. He's lost a lot as a result of the invasion, and I'm sure he wants to have as much as possible to show for it. But so I guess it's now the question is whether the West and Ukraine want to negotiate. And your sense is that no, they don't, I guess, right? I mean, certainly the politics in Ukraine would make it very hard for Zelensky to accept any kind of such deal, you think?
Yeah, we should sort of dwell a bit on the Russian perspective, at least on Putin's perspective and on his supporters' perspective. I don't think they see it as a defeat. I don't think they feel that they lost something by Finland or Sweden joining NATO. I think they regarded these countries as de facto members of NATO, and if you look at NATO's exercises, like I covered for Bloomberg, the largest NATO's exercise since the Cold War in Norway in 2018, and Finland was very much a part of that exercise, and it participated in it just like any other NATO country, and the Swedes were there as well. So I don't think it changes much for Russia. What their view is that this conflict was inevitable. And it was made inevitable by the West, by the American-led West, expanding its structures into the former Soviet Union. The other thing is that they deem themselves to be underdogs in this conflict. They don't see it as, you know, the giant Russia versus smaller Ukraine or small Baltic countries. No, they see the adversary as a much larger military machine and economic machine, and they see themselves as underdogs in this conflict. So they don't get really too upset about losing something like Finnish neutrality.
So Putin, does he have a lot of domestic political support? You know, I saw a thing on Twitter recently where these guys, you know, the Russians with Attitude Twitter feed, they were saying something like, they were commenting on the fact that the rest of Russia has kind of caught up with them in terms of just supporting the war or something. I think I took that to be their meaning. Is your sense that Putin has plenty of public support right now?
The public support in Russia is complicated thing in the way that the Russian population is essentially are essentially hostages to the geopolitical conflict and to Putin's own policies. War is not their choice. Polls show consistent support for Putin's policy, but. When people asked indirect questions, they showed that this support is very lukewarm and tentative. Now there were polls in which people were asked first question like whether they support the special military operation, as they call it. And 70 or something percent would say, yes, yes, we support. And then the second question would be, if Putin withdraws troops from Donbas and says that it's okay, Russia is out of this war and will be on friendly terms with Ukraine thereafter, would you support that? And then again, a majority of Russians would say, yes, yes, we support that as well. So people, I guess majority of people in Russia, they feel extremely uncomfortable in this situation. Millions and millions of people have close relatives in Ukraine or have some personal history in Ukraine. They're not enjoying this situation. At the same time, find themselves in a much more comfortable situation than people in Ukraine. They don't want a war of any kind to come to their porch in the way it came to the porch of their friends and relatives in Ukraine. And that's how Putin is using it. So the support of what they call military operation in Ukraine by the Russian, it dwells primarily on the fear of war coming to Russia. Putin has this narrative of fighting a war on the enemy's soil. That's an ancient narrative. That's what Stalin was trying to do when when Ribbentrop and Molotov signed the agreement, and he divided Poland with Germany. The idea was that if the war begins, they will fight it not on the Soviet territory at the beginning. So that's the idea. People don't want anything like Ukraine to happen to them. And that's where public support derives from.
So in a couple of minutes, we're going to head into the overtime section of this conversation, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. Before we do, I want to ask you one other question. It's about Zelensky firing the commanding general, the guy in charge of the whole war, whose name was what? Something like Zelensky? And apparently he was pretty popular with the public, and replacing him with somebody else. What do you think is going on there?
Well, Zaluzhny was becoming a political figure, and although he was not making major political statements himself, but he allowed himself to publish a couple of articles in the Western media, which contradicted Zelensky's stance on the future of this war and also on mobilization, on how many people the army needs.
He was more pessimistic than Zelensky about the war in these things?
Well, he basically wanted he wanted 500,000 people to be mobilized, which is too much to ask really from the Ukrainian politicians, because the situation with the mobilization is already quite tense in Ukraine, and it's really unpredictable. Mm-hmm. If they really go for mobilizing 500,000 people, so Zaluzhny drew a lot of support from anti-Zelensky opposition, which is rising its head because the official Zelensky's official term is running out in May, and beyond May, he is a wartime president. His legitimacy is more question. Although, legally, constitutionally, he's still the leader, but his legitimacy will be questioned.
But the election probably won't happen, right? Because they're under martial law. But you're saying that, nonetheless, there may be questions about his legitimacy, even though he'll stay in power, having kind of postponed the election. And Zaluzhny was thought of as a possible political rival, I gather, in the long run for Zelensky, right?
No, absolutely. As many, every political scientist in Ukraine would tell you, domestic politics returned to Ukraine at some point recently, and Zaluzhny emerged as the political figure that is supported by most of the anti-Zelensky opposition, which always existed, but it was silenced by the war, essentially.
And what is the big disagreement? In other words, what opinion does Zaluzhny represent about how things should be conducted? You said he wants a more ambitious mobilization. Does that mean in general he's saying Zelensky isn't doing enough to actually win the war? Or is it possible to say which of the two would be more likely to actually do a peace deal with Putin, or what? What is the big difference?
Well, look, it's this big difference is really hard to detect. There is this difference on mobilization, indeed. But when it comes to agreements with Russia, it's not quite clear where the difference is. Mm-hmm. The real thing is that there is struggle for power, and there are forces which are rising their head, which want Zelensky diminished, weakened, and possibly out.
Right. Okay. All right. So, as I said, this is signals the end of the public part of the podcast. Thanks for everybody who's stayed with us for this long. Now we're going to continue the conversation. If you want to listen to it or just want to support conversations like this, you can become a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter by Googling Non-Zero and Substack, or clicking the link at the in the show notes of the podcast app. And then you can get a kind of special podcast feed that just always has the full version of all the conversations. Before we go into overtime, Leonid, I want to give you a chance to, tell people where, we've mentioned your Twitter feed, which I definitely recommend. Tell people anything else about where they can find your stuff. And if there's anything you want to say, by way of punctuation, for anything you've said so far in the conversation, feel free.
Yeah, but I mostly write for my opinion pieces for Al Jazeera and also write for the Norwegian newspaper, Morgenbladet, if any of you read in Norwegian
language. I'll check that out next time I'm in Norway.
I published a book in Norway about the war, about Russian history and the war between Russia and Ukraine. It's called European Tragedy, and it's so far it's only been published in Norwegian language.
So do you speak Norwegian and Latvian?
No, I don't. I speak a bit of Latvian. I don't speak Norwegian. I wouldn't pretend to. I wrote a book in a language I don't speak. But I had a Norwegian co-author, Stan Inge Jorgensen.
I see. Okay. All right. So thanks, everybody who's stayed with us so far. And now we head into overtime.